presented by the U.S. Travel Association.
South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn is often considered the single most important person in helping Joe Biden win the Democratic nomination in 2020. After Biden lost the first three primaries, Clyburn endorsed his old friend in his home state. Biden won South Carolina and rolled to victory on Super Tuesday and beyond. Biden has repaid Clyburn in a number of ways, including by making South Carolina the first presidential primary. In 2024, Clyburn is now one of Biden's six campaign co-chairs. They raise money, act as surrogates, and offer the candidate advice. And they have a few problems to solve. Biden's weakness with Black and Latino voters, the rebellion on the left over Israel's war in Gaza, the continued Democratic carping about the Biden campaign's messaging, Biden's dismal approval ratings. I connected with Clyburn on Thursday afternoon to get a glimpse into how he and his fellow co-chairs are approaching all of this. We also discussed Donald Trump's visit to Capitol Hill, the post-Biden leaders of the Democratic Party, what side he's taking in that New York Democratic primary that's pitting the likes of Hakeem Jeffries against Hillary Clinton, whether he will insist on keeping South Carolina first in 2028, and what he really thinks of his fellow South Carolinians, Lindsey Graham, Tim Scott, Nancy Mace, and Nikki Haley. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's start, Congressman. Let's start with some news from today. I don't know how much you were paying attention to it or how much you care one way or another, but Donald Trump returned to the Hill today. How did it feel to have him back in Washington and back on the Hill first time since January 6th?
Well, his being here prevented me from getting into my garage on time this morning. So that's the story of my life being disrupted by Donald Trump. But other than that, I don't feel anything.
You are one of the Biden campaign's co-chairs. Tell us a little bit about that. What's the job of the campaign co-chair? How formal is it?
I don't know what the job is.
And how did you get it? Did the president call you and tell you? How does it come about? Yeah, it sounds very important.
I guess the president must have called me. I'm supposed to be a co-chair. We meet every Saturday morning, virtually. Some Saturdays I make the meetings and some Saturdays I don't.
What do you guys talk about at the secret co-chair meetings?
They aren't secret at all. We just get updates from the staff.
Can I come to this Saturdays then if it's not secret?
Well, it's not secret, but it's private. There's a big difference in private.
No, seriously, tell us a little bit about the flavor of these meetings and like what's discussed.
We just get updates from the staffs and other entities in the campaign, and they ask us questions. We give advice and that sort of thing. It's just a regular meeting.
What are the hot topics like for the last couple of weeks? I mean, are they the same things we're all discussing about the campaign?
That's what I said. I haven't been on for the last couple of weeks. I've been traveling for the last couple of weeks. This past weekend, I was in Ohio. The weekend before that, I was in Pennsylvania. The weekend coming up, I'd leave Friday night and go into California.
Let's talk about some of the issues in the campaign. Actually, before we get to some of the Biden campaign stuff, I got to ask you about one other thing that's newsy this week.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the George Latimer challenge to Jamal Bowman.
Yeah.
Bowman is obviously a member of the CBC. Some big names like Hillary Clinton have endorsed Latimer. Are you for Bowman or Latimer?
I've contributed to Bowman.
You've contributed financially?
Financially, I contributed to Bowman.
But this is short of a full-on endorsement?
Well, he has not asked me for any kind of endorsement. He asked me for a contribution, and I gave it to him. I tend to respond to candidates based upon what they want me to do. If a candidate calls and says, I'd like for you to come to my district, then I may go. He's not asking anything else of me.
If he calls and asks you to come and campaign for him in his district, what are you going to say?
Well, it all depends. Let's cross that bridge when I get to it.
Has Latimer reached out to you?
No, I don't know Latimer.
And so just tell us about the politics of this. This seems to be one of the most interesting primaries that Democrats are having right now. It's really dividing the party. Ideologically, you seem to be lined up a lot more with George Latimer than Jamal Bowman, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I don't know. I don't know George Latimer. I have no idea about his politics. I don't know him. So I may be lined up with him. I don't know. But if you recall, everybody said the 2020 presidential primary was divisive, and it may have been. But my candidate came out okay.
Well, you're being very modest. You are often considered the single most important person in helping Joe Biden win the nomination and therefore the presidency.
Well, you know, one of the things, you're having a contest. You know, we had 20-some-odd people running for president. 20, I think there was 23 people. 21 of them were at my fish fry a few months before. It wasn't divisive. You just had a contest. The South Carolina primaries are taking place this week. Some people I was for won. Some people I was for, in fact, at least one person I was for didn't win. Lost by 100 votes or something. But we're going to come together as a party, and we're going to try to win that seat and the others as well. So I don't call a contest divisive. I think you got a contest going in New York. In fact, I think I saw somewhere Mondaire Jones endorsed Latimer. And he was a member of the caucus, and he's right there running in the congressional district next to it. So I don't call that divisive. I just call it a contest.
So you could end up doing what Mondaire Jones did and endorse Latimer?
I doubt very seriously. I can't endorse anybody I never met and don't even know anything about. All I know is the name.
Let's talk about the South Carolina primary. One of the great disappointments of there not being an open primary on the Democratic side is we didn't get a Clyburn fish fry this year. But the South Carolina primary was first. Just remind us how that came about.
It came about because Joe Biden wanted South Carolina to be first. But the fact of the matter is, I never asked for South Carolina to be first in the nation. I've always asked for South Carolina to be first in the South. And we were first in the South for years. And I jokingly say, I'm half joking when I say this, I was a baseball player growing up, a pretty good baseball player. And I knew that the most important batter in the lineup is the fourth-place batter. The fourth-place batter in the lineup is called the cleanup hitter. And South Carolina was in fourth place. And I wanted to stay in fourth place.
That's what made you so influential every election.
Absolutely. So why would I want to be first?
All right, so this leads to this question. What about 2028? What do you want? Where do you want South Carolina to be?
I want South Carolina to be anywhere they decide for it to be, really, in 2028.
Will you fight to keep it first?
No. No,
really?
I won't.
You're not going to be like New Hampshire and Iowa that like clings on to this new position.
Well, you know.
And you'd be okay if it went back to fourth, if it went back to cleanup?
It's okay with me. Absolutely.
Okay. This may be a little early, but who do you think the post-Biden top-tier Democratic presidential candidates are? Who do you see as the next crop that you have your eye on and maybe even would like to see run?
How big is the crop?
That's for you to tell me. It could be
okay.
5, 10, 20. I mean, if it's like 2020, it'll be 20.
Well, yeah, it might be closer to 10 than 5. But I see Cory Booker, Wes Moore, what's his name, the governor of California.
Gavin Newsom.
Gavin Newsom, the governor of Pennsylvania.
Shapiro.
Shapiro, yeah. You know, I don't know what's going to happen between now and then. But the governor of North Carolina, Governor Cooper, I think he's a really, really good governor. He's a guy that I would keep my eyes on if I were you guys in the media.
I can't help but notice that Kamala Harris was not on that list.
Well, she's automatically on the list. As vice president, she's automatically on the list. It's not. I don't put her in the next crop. She's in the current crop.
Do you? Can you help us understand the decision, as you understand it, that Joe Biden made in deciding to run for re-election rather than having a primary and a successor taking over and running against Trump? What do you think went into that decision for him? You know, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm sure you remember in 2020, privately, he did tell some people that he was only going to serve one term. His aides actually debated among themselves whether to make that a public pledge. They decided not to. And obviously he decided not to only serve once. But what do you think went into that decision? And did he talk to you about it in the run-up to it?
No. All what you just said is news to me. I didn't know anything about what you just said. I do know that when he asked me my opinion, I said to him I thought he should run. He didn't tell me that he was thinking about one term. He did say in my presence and campaign more than once using the term transitional, that he was going to be a transitional president. And I've said to people
a bridge,
who asked me.
Yeah. And sometimes he would talk about being a bridge, right?
That's right.
Back in 2020. Yeah.
So
the bridge got a little longer, though. Because
absolutely. It doesn't have to be a short bridge. It can be a long bridge. It doesn't have to be a 4-year transition. It can be an 8-year transition. And that's what I said to him. I said, well, let's make this transition an 8-year transition. Because we had to transition. We all transitioned then. Look, we're going through some real trying times. It's like, who was it, Thomas Paine, in his little pamphlet, The Crisis. These are times that try men's souls. And there ain't no room out here for summer soldiers or sunshine patriots. And that's the problem.
Wow, you know the next line. Most people don't know that next line.
Oh, yeah, but I know it. I know it. The summer soldiers and sunshine patriots will in the crisis strength from the service of the country. But he that stands now, deserves and love and thanks of man and woman for tyranny that kale is not easily conquered. We have this consolation with us. The harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
How do you know that? How is that memorized?
I don't know. That's what it says.
You struggled for a second to remember Newsom's name, but you have that quoted absolutely from memory.
Oh yeah, I know Gavin Newsom too, but I sometimes get him mixed up with the current mayor, not the current mayor, but the mayor before. There's another person out there in California I used to get him confused with. Both of them were mayors at one time.
Let me ask you this: I always thought that the decision for Biden was he runs again or he opens up the party to a pretty messy, divisive primary. And, you know, to June 2024, Democrats might still be debating immigration and all the other issues that can be very divisive. And that, you know, the view was that that's actually worse than any downsides that people point to these days with his reelection. Is that the way you looked at it? How do you look at that choice between, you know, running with all of his faults versus opening it up to a potential a primary?
Well, I don't know that the primary would have been all that nasty. I think that you had people like Gavin Newsom. I think Gavin Newsom was hell-bent on running. I think he really, really wanted to run. I think he was positioning himself to run if Biden did not run. And I do think that Cory Booker would have run. I think that there had been a big contest. I'm not too sure the vice president would be the only woman in the race.
Do you think it could have produced a candidate as strong or stronger than Biden?
No.
So at the end of the day, this was the best. This is the best way to go.
I think he was best in 2020. I think he's best today.
Presented by the U.S. Travel Association. Air travel innovations make getting there this summer more safe, secure, and seamless.
You know, I know you get asked this question a lot, but I'm going to ask it as well. And that is this series of polls this year that show Donald Trump doing a whole lot better with black voters than he did in 2020. The Times Siena, when they polled the swing states in May, they had 23% black support for Trump. He won 8% according to the exit polls in 2020. And then the Wall Street Journal broke down an interesting gender divide in April. This was a national poll, and it was 30% of black men said they'll vote for Trump versus 12% in 2020 and 11% of black women versus 6% in 2020. So an interesting gender divide there in terms of Trump doing a little bit better with black men than black women. This is a big shift. I don't think you can deny that these polls are showing something. And I'm, you know, curious as someone who knows a lot about this electorate, what you think of these polls and what they're showing and what Biden needs to do to turn that around.
I don't think he needs to do anything but what he's doing. I think Joe Biden is doing exactly what he needs to do to win re-election. I think the polling is taking place. Something that's amiss with the polling. I call your attention to the recent polls over in Maryland. The African-American woman running for the United States Senate nomination. The Sunday before the election, one poll had her 5 down. The other poll had her 7 down. And she won by 13. Now, how do you explain that? That's 20 points.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what's going on with polling these days. But I do know this, the polls did not have Ossoff nor Warnock winning Georgia, and both of them won. Polls did not have Macbeth getting 80-something% in that district, but she did. So I don't know what's happening here, but I do know this. Anybody who believes that Donald Trump will get 30% of the black male vote or 12% of the black female vote, I got a bridge down there on John's Island, and I'll sell you.
Does it worry you at all? I mean, do you think it doesn't concern you? It's not. Do you think it's something that the campaign needs to be spending any time on and resources, and or you think it'll just naturally tighten as we get closer?
I'm going to tell you what concerns me. What concerns me is the disinformation and misinformation that's being peddled out here. What really concerns me is the fact that for some strange reason, the media are more concerned with trying to balance stories rather than report the facts. That bothers me to no end. And every time I hear these reports about Donald Trump said this, but such and such a thing is the case, giving some excuse for the lie that he's telling, giving some cover, some alternative facts about the lies he's telling. That's what bothers me. There is a generational divide that exists among people, black and white. I got a text from my grandson last night thanking me for a statement I made on Netanyahu's visit. Now, why did he feel the need for that? I didn't sit in that house when Netanyahu was here the last time.
I mean, you're not
going. Nothing new for me not to attend Netanyahu's speech. I didn't attend his last speech here for the same reason I'm not going to attend this one. But for some strange reason, that's some big revelation to my grandson. That ain't no revelation. I've been in this place a long time. Nobody bothers to think about it. So that's what's going on out here, and that's what bothers me. I don't think the reporting on these things, you know, this whole thing about being balanced, be fair and report the stuff as it's happening. This guy's getting away with some horrible stuff, and people just trying to find a balance to these stories, and it doesn't make sense to me.
I know you got to go. Last thing on the Netanyahu thing, you had hinted that there might be some counter-programming during his visit. Any idea what that will look like and how many members might participate in that?
I don't know. I'm meeting with staff today. I intend to do it this morning, but I'm going to meet this afternoon, tell them what's on my mind, and they're going to I've already told them what was on my mind, and they're going to let me know where there may be other folks who may want to have some alternative meetings on this. Irrespective of that, if I'm the only one, I won't be attending.
You're not attending. But no. You might go beyond just not attending and actually do something that gets some attention.
If somebody wants to do so, because I think that those of us who believe in a two-state solution really need to let it be known that this isn't just Joe Biden. Barack Obama was here. I think Bill Clinton was here. This two-state solution is something that we've been for a long time. And I've yet to find out from anybody, what's Trump's position on this? Is he supporting Netanyahu? I think if you want to be president of these United States, you got to be able to lay out a visionary path forward on this country's relationship with the state of Israel. And I haven't seen yet anybody making Trump respond to that issue. Just beating up on Biden and beating up on Biden and then saying one word to Trump about where he stands on that issue.
You mentioned North Carolina. This may be—I don't know how much you pay attention to the nitty-gritty, but there's a kind of conventional wisdom now that of the six swing states out there, you've got the Sun Belt states and the Midwest states, and that Biden's chances are a little bit better in the Midwest than they are in those Sun Belt states of Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, and that North Carolina maybe is on the bubble of the seventh state, and that, you know, is a little out of reach. What's your read of his most promising battleground states?
I do not think that North Carolina is out of reach, not by a long shot.
Do you buy this distinction between the upper tier Midwest states versus the Sun Belt, and that actually his fortunes are a little bit more promising in the Midwest?
That may be true. I have not spent a whole lot of time on that. I've been spending time on Pennsylvania, Michigan. I'm getting ready to go to Wisconsin real soon, and I really think that. If we hold Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, we'll be fine. I have not done the numbers to see exactly what states will make up the required number of electoral votes, but I wouldn't give up on North Carolina or Georgia. I mean, whatever the numbers are showing, because I think the other side is not putting together a campaign to win. They are trying to muddy the water, suppress the vote, depress turnout on our side, because I don't think they can grow their numbers. they're trying to suppress our numbers because they're not going to grow their numbers at all.
You got time for one more question or you got to get going?
Yeah, I got time for one more question.
This one's a fun one. You've got a lot of interesting politicians that South Carolina produced. I want you to give me in order from your favorite to least favorite Republican out of Lindsey Graham, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, and Nancy Mace.
I suspect that, you know, Lindsey and I have a pretty good friends.
Who's that? Which one?
I said Lindsey and I are good friends.
Oh, yeah.
I do mean that generally. We are good friends. I don't agree with him on a lot of things. And I do agree with him on a lot of things. We were able to do a lot we've done with judiciary, especially those judge appointments in South Carolina. He's the senior senator. And we've worked very closely together on all those things. And we've been together on 80% of them, not 100%. So I get along very well with Lindsey. I know Tim. I know the former governor. But I'm much closer to the current governor of South Carolina, who is a Trumpy. Henry McMaster and I are good friends. We've had two press conferences together recently on issues that affect South Carolina. My parents were Republicans. My mother and father were. They were members of the party of Lincoln. So I don't have a knee-jerk reaction to Republicans. I thought you were going to ask me who my favorite Republican. I was going to look up on my wall and look at Robert Smalls. He is my favorite.
Tell us, who's your favorite Republican? I assume this is from the 19th century.
That's exactly right. Robert Smalls. Not just my favorite Republican, but he's the most consequential South Carolinian who ever lived. That's correct. Not John C. Calhoun, not Strom, Thurmond, Wade Hampton. Robert Smalls is the most consequential South Carolinian who ever lived. And I can prove that factually. And you don't have to try to balance that out.
All right, last question, Congressman. And that is, we do this thing on the show where the last question is a question that is proposed by a previous guest, okay? Right. And believe it or not, this one was proposed by Rick Scott a couple of weeks ago. And it's a pretty broad, simple one. And then I'm going to ask you to pick a question for our next guest who you don't even know who it's going to be. So this is a weighty question from Rick Scott. And that is, what is your purpose in life? And I know you're short on time, so that might be a more like an essay question than a quick one. But that's what he asked. And then I'd love for you to come up with one for our next guest.
Oh, no, it's very easy for me. My purpose in life is drawn to rhyme with our Pledge of Allegiance. And it is to make this country's greatness accessible and affordable for all of its citizens. That's my sole purpose. And I've told my daughters that I want that on my tombstone when I take my place alongside their mother. He did his damnedest to make this country's greatness accessible and affordable for all of its citizens. That's my purpose.
That's a great answer. You got a question for us for our next guest?
Well, I think that if you're a person next week is an influencer of any sort, I would like for you to ask them, what do they consider to be this nation's mission at this particular juncture in its history? Are we going to continue our pursuit of a more perfect union, or are we going to take the road most traveled?
Thank you for that. That's a good one. All right, I'll let you go. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Thank you to Joe Dobkin for help editing this week. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Please tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can always email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for listening.